If you find yourself penciling a deal more than once, it's a problem. Online or in-store, Gubagoo's virtual retailing offers a unified experience and ensures a seamless deal every time. Check it out at gubagoo.com.
Want to dive deeper into the topics you hear about on Daily Drive? We're offering listeners a special offer, 20% off a one-year Automotive News digital subscription. That gets you access to all of our news, information, and analysis made for automotive industry leaders like you. Go to autonews.com/dailydrivepromo to redeem.
Welcome to this weekend drive edition of Daily Drive for the second week in March 2024. I'm Kellen Walker in Las Vegas. Today, we're breaking down some of the biggest stories in the auto industry from the past week and looking forward to what's in store in days ahead. Jamie is out this week, but we've got a great guest to help us talk over this week's news. Toyota has been in the news a lot this week, so who better to join us today than our own Larry Valquette, who covers Toyota for us at Automotive News. Larry, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, Kellen. You're right. Who's got it better than us, right?
Of course. So Larry, let's get started. Toyota is tightening control over battery production by buying out partner Panasonic for full ownership of their longtime battery joint venture, Prime Earth EV Energy. Now, Larry, how big of a move is this for Toyota, and will these batteries eventually end up stateside?
Well, Kel, I think what you're looking at here is Toyota making a move to make sure that it has absolute control over its future, right? These batteries are going to underlie, at least for the short term, their battery electric vehicle plans. So Toyota is not one that leaves things to chance anywhere, anytime, for any reason. What you're seeing here with this move, this ownership stake, is simply them locking stuff down for the long term. And it makes sense, especially if you're Toyota. And you're going to be relying on this technology, at least in the interim, and you're going to ramp up volumes for battery electric vehicles globally. You need to have things locked down. What's interesting, though, is if you look at this partnership with Panasonic, it goes back to the earliest days of Toyota hybrids, right? Back to 1996, this partnership between Panasonic supplying the batteries and the battery technology and Toyota. And the fact that it's almost 30 years, right, that this has run through before Toyota finally got full ownership, that's pretty amazing. That is a long, long partnership, especially in this industry.
Yeah, that was kind of my next follow-up question to that is, you know, Toyota having this partnership so long with Panasonic, I mean, going over 30 years, and the Prius being as big as it was, I'm surprised Toyota didn't make a move like this maybe 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah, I think other automakers probably would have, but Toyota in its DNA works very well with its partners, with its supplier partners. Toyota always leads or is among the leaders of our annual supplier survey index. They do a phenomenal job working with their suppliers. So much so, in fact, if you remember earlier this year, there was a story about Toyota actually paying some extra money to its suppliers to make sure that they were healthy.
Right.
They really see value in partnerships like this. And I think in this case, it worked well. There was no reason to change it. If you noticed in the story that we wrote about and this transaction, the ownership stake that Toyota has had has climbed over time. It's not throwing them to the curb. It's just kind of easing them out of this business after, you know, 28 years.
Is this the type of, I guess, Larry, business model that other automakers should take up when it comes to suppliers, of having this blossoming relationship with suppliers like Toyota has, and almost essentially putting their suppliers first? Do a lot of other legacy automakers follow that blueprint, or is Toyota kind of one in its own when it comes to that?
It's not alone in it, but it's certainly lonely, right?
Gotcha.
It's not a big crowd. I have covered both automakers on both ends of the spectrum. And let me tell you, what happens is when a supplier has great relationships with an OEM, when the supplier develops a new technology, when it develops something exciting, where do you think it takes it first, right? It takes it to the OEM with whom it has the best relationship.
Right.
And Toyota has benefited from that over the years. Other automakers have viewed purchasing as a cudgel. I mean, the stories are go back decades of OEMs fighting suppliers over a nickel, over a dime per part, and signing a contract with a supplier and then asking them, oh, by the way, we're going to need less than what we just promised you that we would pay you.
Right.
Those kind of adversarial relationships, you know, they might look great on the bottom line, but they do not work long term. And Toyota, if it has one underwriting principle, it is that it plays for the long term.
Right. Well, Larry, in some more Toyota news, Toyota hit a milestone in February, reporting its best ever monthly percentage of what it calls electrified vehicles, hybrids, plug-in hybrids, and BEVs, hitting 37% of its total 184,000 sales between its two brands. While the growth rate for BEVs has slowed, hybrids and plug-ins are gaining some traction. What do you think is going on there? And is this a long-term trend? And Larry, quite frankly, is the BEV parade over?
No, the parade's not over, but the pace has slowed down, right? It's just not quite going at the same breakneck speed that it was. We have some percentage of our society that wants to see that BEV transition happen overnight. And I don't think our infrastructure is going to handle that. Right. I don't think anybody is going to handle that. Toyota, from the start, has taken an approach that said, okay, look, we're eventually going to transition as a society to at least a majority of EV propulsion, but it's going to take us some time to get there, right? It took the better part of 30, 40 years to get gas stations to where they are now, right? In the early part of the last century. It's going to take some time to build out charging infrastructure and to make sure that it works, right? That you can do a direct percentage. Toyota has always viewed that transition as saying, look, we can do certain things to cut carbon and we can get there, take some interim steps, make sure that we're not just polluting, and then turning it off, right? As we all make this very, very hard switch. Toyota has said, let's develop hybrids, which they pioneered back in the 90s, and then later plug-in hybrids as interim steps. Still, they offer every type of powertrain, right? That's their mantra right now. Their mantra is the enemy is carbon. It's not ICE vehicles. So right. If I can drive carbon out, I can reduce my pollution. So I think what you're seeing with the, especially in February when it reached 37%, I think from consumers, the curiosity about battery electrics is real. All you have to do is talk to your neighbors, right?
Right.
Especially if you do what we do, Cal, what are they going to say? Well, you know, those electric vehicles, I don't know if they're for me.
Right.
And that's fine, right? What's that show? That shows that they're considering it.
Right.
They may not have decided yet, but they're considering it. So what are hybrids and plug-ins? They're an interim step. They're a way for a consumer to say, okay, well, I can try this, but I can do it without pain. I still know I'm going to get where I need to go. I can still take the trip across country. But I know, as someone who's owned three straight hybrids now, all from Ford, by the way, using Toyota technology in my Fords, I can tell you that you suddenly start noticing, okay, well, I've driven 50 miles and 15 of those miles were on battery power. And they go, okay. Well, that's pretty cool. I got, you know, I saved some money at the gas pump and I did some cool things for the environment. And, you know, maybe next time down the road when the infrastructure is better, I can make the jump. That's where hybrids and plug-in hybrids are really valuable right now. And I think what you're seeing is other automakers responding to this instead of the market, right? If we go back 5 years, the market told these automakers, oh, the only way we're going to reward you in your stock price is if you try to turn yourself into the next Tesla. Tesla doesn't have all those legacy costs that the legacy automakers do. So there were a couple automakers that jumped that said, yes, we'll do this for various reasons. We'll go all EV. We believe in this future. And ultimately, they're all going to go EV. It's just going to take several decades as we transition.
No, I agree. I definitely see hybrids and plug-in hybrids playing the role of essentially being the trust builder that will build the trust for folks who'll be able to be like, all right, I can fully do this. Because, you know, I'm an EV owner, and I folks tell me all the time, they're like, well, you don't ever get scared of running out of battery? And I'm like, no. Like, and so those skeptics, you know, that are those folks that have the range anxiety and things like that, I think a hybrid, plug-in hybrid, is perfect for them. Have one of those for about 4 or 5 years. You build the trust, and then you can go and make the complete jump. Now, me personally, I just jumped off the cliff and went immediately from ICE vehicle to electric vehicle.
So before you got your first BEV, Cal, what did you have before?
Oh, I had an S6 Audi.
Oh, okay. Well,
I mean, every car I had, the last 3 or 4 cars I had, were gas guzzling monsters. And then Now I'm running around here with a key card. Here is the strangest part about owning an EV, is not carrying keys. I think that is the part that you have to get used to. Then after a while, you're like, oh, wow. Like, I don't carry keys. You know, my phone unlocks my car. So very, very interesting.
Do you still carry the key ring just for old time's sake?
Just for old time's sake, just for memory. Oh, it's strange when I take my wife's SUV, because I'm like, God, I got to carry all this, all these keys, all this jingling. I got all this stuff in my pockets. You know.
Oh, humanity.
The humanity. So Larry, we also got an email this week from a listener, which you can send your questions to us at dailydrive@autonews.com. And it's from Mark in the UK. He says he's an EV driver who drives nearly 130,000 miles without gasoline or diesel. And he's convinced EVs will reach full adoption faster than many people in the industry or in government think. Now, he says, quote, I never hear you mention the fact that EVs are so much better for the owner/driver, but not just a bit, but significantly so. Larry, as someone who covers Toyota, one of the slowest automakers to adopt EVs, what do you think about Mark's thoughts and the idea that EVs are cheaper to own, better to drive, and easier to maintain?
Well, I will say this. He's right, but he's right for a guy who lives on an island.
Right.
for a guy, and you know, God love him. I was in England this last summer. For a guy that lives on an island, he's absolutely correct. There are real benefits. And you yourself, Kel, know that driving EV is fun. It's the acceleration, that the torque is, when you first experience it, is a little mind blowing.
Yeah.
Now, even on a mid-level EV, that's just something that you're not expecting. It's quieter. The technology is a lot of fun. But in the United States, we have distances that are just right now beyond what this technology is able to hit. The longest distance that you can drive in England is about 700 miles, right? That's from the southern end to the northern end. It's about 700 miles. So at today's technology, that's one stop, one charging stop, maybe two, depending on the vehicle. I can do that and still almost stay in Michigan.
Right.
Right? from where I live down on the southeast corner up to that very northwest corner by Lake Superior in Minnesota and Wisconsin, that's a long drive. And that's one state.
Right.
Right? Now you're talking about if I drive down to Florida, there's 2,000 miles, right? That's three times that distance. We'll get there. This is what I would say to Mark. The U.S. will get there, but it's going to take some time, and it's going to take some better technology. We have just come out of the bag phone version of EVs, right? We're maybe at the Motorola StarTAC now.
Oh, man.
Right?
Right.
The only texting I can do is I can spell Shell Oil. Right? Upside down. That's where we're at right now, right?
Right.
We're not going to get to an iPhone for a couple decades.
Right.
But we're going to get there. And it's going to take time. And the technology is going to get better. And the battery technology is going to get better. So Mark has the benefit of living in a place where these things make perfect sense right now. We do not have that benefit. Or at least I don't. You know, Kel, I know you already do it. So what the hell?
Yeah, no, I get it. He lives on an island, and it's a lot different. It's almost like living here in Vegas, where everything is 15 to 20 minutes away. So it's not like I drive far distances on a regular basis. So depending on how isolated whatever city it is that you live in, depends on how your needs are going to be met. So no, it totally makes sense.
And I will say this, EVs, for their shortcomings still, right? The technology shortcomings still, they make fantastic second cars.
Yes.
If you have two cars in your family right now, one of them should be an EV.
Yes, I agree.
Or could be an EV. 95% of what you're doing you're going to be able to do with that EV. And even hell, with a plug-in hybrid, you can do it if you don't want to jump all the way. But 95% should be with an EV, which is why so many early Tesla owners, right? If you looked in their garage, yeah, they had a Tesla sitting there, but they also had an Escalade. Right? They had a Suburban or a Tahoe or an Expedition, or they had something in there that when they needed a tow, it could tow. When they needed to go long distances, they could do so without having to worry about it.
Perfect. Coming up, is the possible entry of Chinese automakers into the U.S. market any different from Japanese automakers doing the same thing more than six decades ago? Larry wrote about it on autonews.com, and we'll talk about it next on Weekend Drive.
We want to hear your voice on Daily Drive. What would you like us to talk about this week on our Weekend Drive episode of the show? What are some of the biggest industry trends or news stories you're thinking about?
Send us a voicemail, text, or email, and you might hear it on the next edition of Weekend Drive. Here's how you can get in touch.
Call us and leave a voicemail or text at 313-444-2774. Again, that's 313-444-2774. You can also record your voice on your smartphone and send it to dailydrive@autonews.com. That's dailydrive, one word, @autonews.com.
And tune into the show this weekend. You might hear your question or comment.
We know 95% of customers complete at least a portion of their vehicle buying journey online, so they expect the deal they create on your website to match exactly what they see in your showroom. If it doesn't, you can lose that customer's trust, risking not only that deal, but also any future opportunities. That's where Gubagoo's virtual retailing steps in. We transform the conventional car buying process into a modern, transparent, and seamless experience. With Gubagoo, you'll be able to access information the customer entered online, such as their favorite vehicles, in-progress deals, and any pending orders when they enter your dealership. And our industry-leading F&I process averages nearly 3 times greater revenue per deal, thanks to our smart menus and bundles. Did we mention that virtual retailing is fully integrated with our premium chat solution? Real-time messaging and live support from our team of specialists brings the engagement of your showroom directly to your website. Don't let disconnected experiences drive customers away. Try virtual retailing by Gubagoo, where seamless meets success. Discover the difference and see why over 8,000 dealers and 20 OEMs trust us at gubagoo.com. That's GUBAGOO.com.
Welcome back to Weekend Drive. I'm Kellen Walker with Larry Valquette, who covers Toyota for us at Automotive News. Larry, you sat down with Ted Ogawa, CEO of Toyota Motor North America, for a conversation about Chinese automakers entering the U.S. market. In your column, you posed a very good question. When China finally enters the U.S. market, will it be an invader like it has been in Europe, or a disruptor? I also want to follow up with that, Larry, with what makes this different from when Japanese automakers entered the U.S. market in the late 1950s?
Yeah, Kel, so this is a thing that's been weighing on my mind for a while, and I talked to Ted Ogawa about it. To me, it's really interesting, right? If you look at our pages on a weekly basis and our website on a daily basis, you'll see people freaking out about Chinese automakers coming into the U.S. And, you know, maybe with good reason. Look at what's happening with Europe. Chinese automakers are coming in and they are grabbing market share. And how are they doing that? With price. Legacy European automakers have bunch themselves into a Stratus from, you know, the lowest up to these luxury brands. And here comes China and just ripping out the bottom part of this, right? And undercutting every one of those automakers by thousands, if not tens of thousands of dollars. And if that happens, if and when that happens in the U.S., if it happens like that, well, that's not just going to be disruption. That's an invasion, right? Mm. But it occurred to me while everyone was raising these protectionist flags, I had to ask myself, why was this different than what Japan did, the Nissan and Toyota, when they came in 1958, right? Late 1950s, they sold their first cars in the U.S. Why is this different? And I think the difference at the time was what Japan was offering was not the same vehicle as what you could get elsewhere. You got to remember, at this point in time, Detroit had what used to be the big three, right? They had maybe 85, 90% market share between the three of them. Very, very little room for anybody else. So Toyota comes in and Nissan, and they offer things that Detroit just wasn't offering at the time. Small cars, fuel efficient cars. You compare a 1958 Chevy Bel Air, right, to a right. Toyota Toyopet, right? You could have put the Toyopet in the trunk of the Bel Air.
Right, almost. Right.
You know, these were different cars. And look at the same thing, Fiat later on. They're just different parts of the world using different vehicles than what we had. Again, probably mostly because of our space and the bounty in post-World War America. But I think if China takes the path that Japan did, which is we're going to offer something that's not in the market here, we're not going to play price games, right? We're going to play a long-term game where we're going to try and ingratiate ourselves to Americans. We'll grow our market share naturally. Then I think there'll be a disruptor still, but I think we'll compete. Right. I think we'll find a way to compete, and we'll compete not only through what we can do, but the growth that the problems that China is going to have as it matures as a capitalist society, at least in terms of the auto industry, right? They're going to have labor problems. They're going to have supply shortages, just like we have. I think long-term, they would be more of a disruptor then. But if they come in like they did in Europe and just undercut every segment, that's going to be a real problem.
But Larry, do you think like Americans are a little different because, you know, we want the latest and greatest technology. Now, for instance, like I've seen videos online of like BYD. It was a video of like a BYD coming off the line. And personally, I don't find them aesthetically pleasing, but I get it. Like for price point, that could be that $15,000 EV. So I could see why price being the main reason why someone be interested in it. But I mean, when it comes to the actual technology, it's like, okay, you're going to get probably a decent battery that's going to get you to point A to point B. And do you think that would be something that's even good enough for the American market that Americans would even want to spend their hard-earned dollar on?
Yes. And I will give you a one-word answer to this. Kia.
Right? Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's all you needed to say. No, I get it. Okay. I get it now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You and I are old enough to remember when Kia came in the market, right? And
oh, I remember.
Yeah. Look at Kia today. Yeah.
Right.
A couple of years ago, Kia and Hyundai led this industry in quality. That is mind-blowing to me as somebody old enough to remember when they first came in the market. And you look at their popularity, right? So I think there is definitely room in this market, especially at the average transaction prices that we're at and the tiny number of vehicles that are priced under $25,000 now relative to the whole market. There is definitely room for somebody to come in and just vacuum up market share with a cheap car. Look at how well the Ford Maverick is selling. It's not cutting edge technology. Hell, it's the last generation technology repackaged into a frame that focuses on cost, and they can't make enough of them. How do I know? Because I waited 14 months for mine.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. Well, let's say, Larry, hypothetically, let's say the Chinese export brands to the U.S. Could the U.S. government add an addendum limiting the number of Chinese vehicles that could enter the market, or would that affect all foreign automakers?
Theoretically, yeah. The U.S. government is pretty able to do whatever the heck it wants to do in terms of trade policy. There's damn few things that they go, oh, well, we just can't do that.
But what I'm saying though, Larry, like without violating anything or I guess aggravating anyone, I would say.
Yeah, here's what I'll say. The trading relationship between the United States and China is strained at best. In the best of times, it is strained. In the worst of times, it is bordering on a commercial war, right? A cold war in economic terms, not obviously in war terms. I think the United States government could, because of the threat that it poses to not only domestic auto operations, but to domestic auto dealers. You're talking about one of the 15 largest segments in the economy, in the overall economy, in the auto industry. Right. You could easily see them say, nope, just like they did with the chicken tax decades ago, that now protects pickups and keeps them the money spitters that they always have been. You could definitely see them take those protectionist angles, and it probably wouldn't cost them a whole lot, because the chance for China to retaliate, except for perhaps in the financial sector, is pretty limited. We don't send a whole lot of stuff into China that would be direct. So yeah, they could do it. I don't think they will, though. They would take that very lightly. But take that action as a last resort. What would be really interesting is if they do as we suspect, right? Which is they'll build factories in Mexico.
Right.
Where these are now suddenly Mexican-built vehicles, no different than, you know, a car from GM or Stellantis or Volkswagen or Toyota, that just take advantage of another free trade agreement that Mexico has.
Gotcha. Well, Larry, very insightful conversation. Larry Velquet covers Toyota and Subaru for us at Automotive News. Larry, thank you so much for joining me today.
What a great way to spend my weekend, Gil.
That's all for this Weekend Drive edition of Daily Drive. I'm Kellen Walker. Thanks to Automotive News coordinating producer Jake Neer for his help on today's podcast. You can get the latest news on Chinese automakers, plans for North America, electrification, and everything happening in the auto industry at autonews.com. Come back on Monday for a look at the 20th anniversary of the first DARPA Grand Challenge, which sparked the self-driving industry as we know today.
The Grand Challenge, it joined together, you know, the government, you know, real commercial players with academics to create a community to do ground-based autonomy that still lives today and sparks all of these, you know, intricacies and, you know, dramas that we have seen subsequently.
If you enjoy the podcast, remember to like, leave a review, and subscribe so you never miss an episode.